Mercy Spirituality Centre presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Centre in Ipsum. We are a centre for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, the Catholic Church, or social justice. Today, my visitor is Richard McLeod. Richard, a warm welcome and Haida Maitea Radio program.
Thank you. Hello.
Richard McLeod is an Auckland-based human rights, refugee, and immigration lawyer. He has successfully represented many hundreds of refugee asylum cases in New Zealand. In addition, Richard is a euthanasia commentator and has spoken at several churches at the Auckland and the Auckland Cathedral, the Catholic Cathedral, about the current end-of-life choice bill, a bill that is currently in the ballot and for which submissions are due by the 6th of March. Richard, you are a human rights lawyer and you are advocating against euthanasia. How did you get involved in this topic?
Well, it's a topic that I personally feel very concerned and alarmed about. I have been involved with the Nathaniel Bioethics Centre in Wellington for many years. I've been in regular contact with them and know the issue and know the problem quite well. I was also the instructing solicitor for the Care Alliance in the Lucretia Seals and the Attorney General case, which, as you know, was argued in the High Court in Wellington in 2015. The Care Alliance, which comprises a number of medical and other groups, concerned groups in New Zealand, sought intervention status when Lucretia Seals brought her right to die case to the High Court, and I was instructing solicitor in that matter. But it is a topic that I know a reasonable amount about and something that I feel very strongly about.
And this bill is currently before a parliamentary select committee and it's very controversial. Can you tell us a little bit more about this bill?
Well, the bill is called the End of Life Choice Bill. It's a variation on other previous bills that have been tabled or put into the private members' ballot in the past. There was previously a bill called Death with Dignity that never got through. Marion Street in 2012, I believe, put in the End of Life Choices Bill. This one is a slight variation of that. It's been tendered by David Seymour. It's a private members' bill which has now been drawn from the ballot and voted through by our Parliament at its first reading in December last year. And essentially, what the bill seeks to achieve is to introduce into New Zealand euthanasia, which is defined as the voluntary taking of a person's life by a doctor with their consent. But it can also include involuntary euthanasia, which is the taking of a person's life by a doctor without that person's consent or explicit consent. And it also introduces into New Zealand law or proposes to introduce what we call medically assisted dying, which effectively is a euphemism for assisted suicide.
It's just to put it in different words.
Exactly. In fact, one notable feature of the bill is that there is no mention of the word suicide anywhere, either in the explanatory note to the bill or in any of the provisions of the bill, even though we know that the enactment of this bill would require some fundamental changes to all of the laws that we have around suicide and homicide. The fact that it is notably absent from the bill is something that I think is suggestive of what it is trying to achieve and also what it is trying to conceal. What the bill, in fact, introduces is a new term called assisted dying, and that word appears 67 times throughout the bill and its explanatory note, and that is what is being presented to us. But what assisted dying essentially is, coming back to definitions, is either euthanasia, where a doctor is asked by a patient to administer a lethal poison to take that person's life, or a doctor does that with the patient's consent, or assisted suicide, where a doctor effectively hands the pill to the patient and enables the patient to take their own lives. So the Seymour, David Seymour camp and their supporters would like to bring this bill into New Zealand law. And the feature of the bill is its eligibility criteria. Who is going to be eligible to access euthanasia and assisted suicide under this bill? That is really the question on everybody's lips. But the bill provides no exhaustive or even non-exhaustive list of all of the conditions, illnesses, diseases, afflictions that may qualify a person for euthanasia or suicide in New Zealand law. What it instead does, it sets out eligibility criteria, and they are firstly that the person must be aged 18 years of age and over, although the Attorney-General recently in their report to Parliament pointed out that that age requirement unfairly discriminated against 16 and 17-year-olds, and so I suspect that the bill will be amended to now enable 16 and 17-year-olds to access assisted suicide and euthanasia as well.
When you say eligibility, that already implies that you can decide by yourself. That means that anybody who is under pressure and decides on how somebody else wants you to decide is that eligible? Or what about persons who can't talk, who can't communicate? Well, they might communicate, but you're not 100% sure if that's really what they want. So eligibility means, to me, that you are in full conscience.
I suppose you're now probably moving towards what we call the competence criteria in the bill, and I'll get to those in just a moment, because I think firstly let's see which conditions are eligible, and then we can maybe then talk about the competence issue as well, because that's an important issue. Who is eligible? A person over 18, a New Zealand citizen or permanent resident, suffering from a terminal illness that is likely to end their lives within the next 6 months, or a grievous and irremediable medical condition. And then the person needs to be in an advanced state of irreversible decline in capability. And finally, they must experience unbearable suffering that can't be relieved in a way that they consider to be tolerable. And then we get to they must also be competent. And we'll come back to that in just a moment, because I think the first and perhaps most obvious concern about this bill is how do you define a person suffering from terminal illness likely to end life within 6 months, or a grievous and irremediable medical condition? Terminal illness, as we know from many doctors, is not always easy to predict. A doctor may say to someone, your illness is terminal, it's going to end your life, but it might be very difficult to put an accurate prognosis on a person's life and how much longer they have to live, particularly if they submit themselves to chemotherapy or treatment for that illness or condition. And so at the very outset, it's very difficult to know when a person is going to die. Doctors try to predict it. They are often wrong. They admit that. And so the risk of premature death by assisted suicide and euthanasia is made obvious by that very definition of having to have a terminal illness likely to end your life in the next 6 months. The other criterion, and perhaps the most concerning eligibility criterion in this list of criteria, is if you have a non-terminal illness, but it's an illness that is grievous, which means serious, and irremediable, and a medical condition. So it's a grievous and irremediable medical condition. So that means a serious medical condition which is not able to be cured. What is meant by that? What are medical conditions? What are grievous and irremediable medical conditions? And we know from the variety of medical definitions that a medical condition can include any disease, an illness. It can include an injury. It can include any physiological, mental, psychological condition or a disorder. It could include cerebral palsy, for example, epilepsy, muscular dystrophy, multiple sclerosis, cancer, coronary artery disease, diabetes, mental retardation, emotional or mental illness. So there's a very broad definition of what constitutes a medical condition.
And that's not clarified in the bill.
It's not clarified in the bill. And it's unfortunate that David Seymour, in a recent public statement, said there's just no way that depressed people are going to be covered by this bill. They couldn't, because they don't meet the eligibility criteria. And I don't accept that argument, because a person with a mental illness will undoubtedly fall within the definition of a grievous medical condition. If it's a serious mental illness, schizophrenia, severe depression or chronic depression.
It sounds to me like a little bit like you make an agreement. If you're in favor or against it, you decide on something that you only see from the outside, a contract, and then comes the terms and conditions in the small print that you're only getting once you've bought it.
That's right, yeah, exactly. And once you've bought it, it's too late to undo it, of course, because the nature of death is that it is irreversible. Irremediable, irreversible, these are very, very quite loose definitions when it comes to medical conditions. Some may argue, of course, that schizophrenia is an irreversible, irremediable medical condition. It can't be cured. Even severe depression, one could argue that is irremediable in the sense that it can't be cured. It can be treated. It can be managed, but it can't be cured. And so on a strict reading of this definition, depression, schizophrenia, those types of medical conditions, mental illnesses, are eligible under this bill. And then we move to the competency criteria. Now, of course, David Seymour's claim that depressed people won't be eligible under this bill, I think, is made mostly on the premise that they wouldn't pass the competency requirements for euthanasia or medically assisted suicide. So what are those requirements? The only requirement in this proposed law for competency is this, that the person needs to understand the nature of assisted dying, as they call it, and the consequences for them. In other words, all they need to understand is what the process involves, which is the administration of a lethal injection or a pill that is a poison, and that they understand that the consequence of them taking the pill is that they will die. That is as far as it goes when it comes to a doctor assessing a person's competence for euthanasia or assisted suicide under this bill. And you could very easily argue that many depressed people, many people who are schizophrenic, suffer from mental illnesses, bipolar disorder, manic depression, are quite capable of understanding what this process involves and what the result of the process will be. And so there is actually nothing in the definition or even elsewhere in the bill that could logically prevent a person from requesting assisted suicide or euthanasia who is depressed, or a doctor from refusing it on that very basis because of the eligibility criteria and the way that they're drafted.
And Richard, I also understand that this bill is different. You mentioned previous attempts to introduce euthanasia in New Zealand, and this bill is different to the one that was in the ballot 1 or 2 years ago. Can you point out some of the differences? Because you mentioned that it was just a word that was different, but is the content also different?
Marion Street's End of Life Choices Bill, which was in the ballot some years ago and which was pulled from the ballot before the 2014 election, I think because it was a controversial topic that Labor did not want really to have debated at that point in time. Her bill contained broadly similar provisions to the Seymour bill, but there were two notable differences in her bill. The first was the presence in her proposed bill of what we call end-of-life directives. This is where a person who either already meets the eligibility criteria or thinks that they may meet the eligibility criteria at some point in their life decides that they want to insert in their will or elsewhere a written directive which instructs a doctor what to do with them if they reach if they have a condition that eventuates, or if they reach a point in that condition where they consider at this point in time their lives will be unbearable.
But you can change your mind.
Well, you can change your mind, but one of the major problems with end-of-life directives, and I think one of the reasons why Seymour pulled that from his current bill, is that you can change your mind, but often if you do change your mind, it can be too late. For example, a person signs an end-of-life directive saying that if I contract a mental illness, a mental condition of some nature, a medical condition that reaches a point which has become serious, irremediable, and which is creating some sort of suffering, I consent to being euthanized. But if that person develops dementia, for example, and then at the point in time where their dementia has reached a level where their doctor or their family members, and this is where things get very thorny and tricky, decide that they are now eligible, they can be euthanized. Now, what happens if the dementia patient changes their mind in their state of dementia and do not want to die and resist death? Effectively, what will then take place will be an execution. And we saw this recently in the Netherlands, where a woman who was suffering from dementia was essentially executed by a doctor in a circumstances which involved first her coffee being a sedative being slipped into her coffee, and then she was held down by family and the doctor and was basically injected with a lethal injection to take her life, despite her protestations at that point. So this is where end-of-life directives, advanced directives is another word for them, become very, very dangerous and difficult. Because how can we assess what somebody intends at any one point in time based on something they may have written 5, 10, 15 years ago? And that's where I think things get very difficult. And that's not in this bill. Seymour has taken it out. But that does not mean that if his law passes, they will not be put into the new law by way of an amendment. And it makes sense that they would be. Because you see, and we'll come to this soon, once you create a right to die, once you create, once you give a person by law a legally enforceable right to access euthanasia or assisted suicide, it becomes their right to plan for that event. And if it is their right to plan for it, why not allow them the right to prepare a written statement that essentially dictates what is to be done with them in that event, regardless of whether they may change their mind at the time of the event.
You mentioned earlier suicide and homicide, which of course are words that are not mentioned at all. But if somebody plans a homicide and knows that a person has signed this kind of paper, would it be possible that this person prepares the situation so that the affected person would get in the situation where the doctors would say, yeah, that's the state that he did not want, or he or she did not want to live in, so we'd have to euthanize?
Well, that's right. We get then into very difficult, dangerous, and subjective conjecture and opinions by doctors, by family members of the person who has signed a statement at some point in their past. And that is why end-of-life directives are so concerning. In fact, Margaret Wilson, one of the former attorney generals, had expressed concerns about whether end-of-life directives were consistent with Section 8 of our Bill of Rights Act, which protects the right to life, and she had concluded that they were not. But as I said before, once you legalise a right to die, then it logically follows that people will then expect to be able to plan for the execution, for want of a better word, of that right. Mm-hmm. Another thing that is also not that was in the previous Marion Street bill, but is not in the current bill, is what we call an offence of frustrating the will of a person. Marion Street had decided, we need to protect the right of that person if they exercise it. We need to protect that from interference. And so she wanted to make it an offence for any person who acts, intercedes, to frustrate the will of a person who has decided to submit themselves to this procedure, which is highly problematic. Highly problematic. What does it even mean? Does it mean that a doctor can't try to talk a person out of submitting to this procedure? Does it mean that a family member, a loved one, a friend can't try to talk some sense into their friend, family member, loved one, try to talk them out of doing it? That is exactly what it was designed to do. And frustrating the will of a person committing suicide is actually something that our law recognizes as a good. And the reason it does that is because As a society, our public policy recognises that suicide is a social evil that needs to be eliminated, ideally, and certainly prevented. And it makes it a justifiable defence under the Crimes Act to physically, forcefully assault a person who is committing suicide, to prevent them from carrying out that act. In other words, it's the usual offence of assault does not apply if you try to prevent someone from jumping off a cliff by force. If you try to, if you physically assault a person who is trying to take their own life in some way, and that is a very problematic provision in the context of this whole discussion about assisted dying or assisted suicide and euthanasia. What will happen to Section 41 of our Crimes Act, which provides this right to intervene, this right to frustrate the will of a person wanting to commit suicide? What will happen if a person finds out that their loved one has decided to undergo medically assisted suicide or euthanasia and physically enters the room and tries to prevent the procedure from taking place, assaults their loved one in the process of doing that? Could they be prosecuted under Section 41? Should they be prosecuted? Will they be prosecuted? They are interfering with a so-called right of a person. So one would think that there would be some changes made to that Crimes Act provision.
What happens if the doctor says, "I'm not going to help"? Can the doctor, if that bill became law, would the doctor be obliged to carry out assisted suicide or assisted dying?
This is a question that a lot of people want to know, including doctors. Under this bill, if it becomes law, all doctors will be required to play a part in the facilitation of assisted suicide or euthanasia. Now, David Seymour says, no, that's not right, because we have this conscientious objection clause in the bill. But the conscientious objection clause, although it permits a doctor to say to a patient, look, I have an objection, conscientious objection to that course of action, I can't be involved in the process, the bill then requires that doctor to refer the person to the SENS group, which is a group that will be statutorily created by government to assist that person in executing their right to die. I'll repeat that. The doctors are able to express a conscientious objection, but they must refer the patient to somebody who can help them commit suicide or to euthanize them. And so that really makes the whole conscientious objection that many, many doctors, I believe, are going to have to this procedure. And we know that there are many of them, because only some 30% of doctors in New Zealand, according to some polls, think that that this is a good thing. It is going to require all doctors, whether they have a conscientious objection or not, to become a part of the process. And there is nothing they can do to stop that. And in fact,
they're not even allowed to stop it. If they started to talk into the patient and try to convince them to change their mind, could that be seen as interfering in somebody's right?
I think that it's likely to be interpreted that way. Although there is no, as I said, there's no frustration, the will interference offence provision in the Act, I think it is likely as a result of this bill to be unlawful for a doctor to try and encourage or persuade a person from not exercising that right. So I think, yeah, there are real concerns for doctors, all doctors around this, and the, yeah.
I see the time that it's running. I think that we can have a conversation for a really long time. And I just want to point out also there is in a statement in which Ngā Whaia Atawhai, Sisters of Mercy New Zealand, oppose any law which would provide for the legalization of assisted dying. It says, good end-of-life care, palliative or hospice care, aims to enable people to live fully and comfortably to the natural end of their lives and to die in peace and dignity. Do you think that with that, if that bill becomes a law, that there will be less concern and less investment in palliative care and in painkillers?
Oh yes, I think palliative care is certainly something that's going to be affected. But why do I oppose this bill? I'm a human rights lawyer. My job is to protect the vulnerable against the state. That is what I do. And when I see a proposed law that's going to allow our government to oversee a process that kills the most vulnerable New Zealanders amongst us, or that helps them to commit suicide, how can I stay silent on that issue? It is a very concerning problem. The bill, although it's proclaimed by Mr. Seymour as being something only for a few New Zealanders, it's actually going to cause, in my view, unspeakable harm to our country's most vulnerable. And I'm talking about the hundreds of thousands of elderly, physically incapacitated or terminally ill, intellectually disabled, physically disabled, and mentally ill people in New Zealand.
Just one last question, just because it is such a complex topic. Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned, we're talking about withholding and withdrawing treatment of a patient. Is that euthanasia?
No. Withdrawal of life-saving treatment is not euthanasia. The refusal by a patient of life-saving treatment is not euthanasia or assisted suicide. That is simply allowing nature to take its course and allowing the person to die naturally. So they are not euthanasia.
Thank you very much. That was really very interesting, and I think that it brings a little bit of light in all this complex box of darkness, because, as I said, I feel like it's a bill that is you only see the surrounding, you see the outside, and it's packed in different ways. And so if somebody has written a submission already regarding this bill 2 years ago, that would not count. Do I understand right? Because
that's
you
right.
Said it's new, it's a new bill.
That's right. It's important to remember this is not a repeat of the previous process. This is a new select committee now considering a law. And so if you want to write a submission opposing the bill, then now's the time, because there won't be another chance.
And we'll put the link on the website and the Facebook page. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you.
On the 7th of March, Sister Elizabeth Snedden is coming from 10 o'clock to noon, and she'll present a muffin meeting on the topic of discerning the threats of connectedness. And if you'd like to know about all our other programs, please have a look at our website or Facebook page. And for all our events at the Centre, please register with us per phone at Auckland 09-638-6238 or via our website at www.mercyspiritualitycentre.org.nz. I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you, Richard. Yeah.